What's up, War Stories fans? I want to talk to you about Ocker Leather Duty Gear for a minute. When performance is your number one priority, we all know choosing the right gear for the job is crucial to your mission success. I used Ocker Leather Duty Gear almost exclusively. If they made it, that's what I used. Ocker Leather Duty Gear gives you the confidence to perform at the highest level in the field, day in and day out. With over 40 years of experience crafting high-quality products for the law enforcement community, Ocker Leather specializes in making holsters, belts, and all the other accessories, and they stand the test of time. Let me tell you, I still have all my Ocker Duty gear, and it is well worn in, but still as nice as the day I got it. Major municipal and federal agencies from LAPD and Border Patrol trust Ocker to outfit their officers with duty gear that wears in and not out. And it's made in America since 1981, so that is awesome. Ocker is renowned for being the best name in leather, so visit OckerLeather.com and use the coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order. That's Adam, King, Edward, Robert, Lincoln, Edward, Adam, Tom, Henry, Edward, Robert.com and use coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order.
Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And we are back for another episode. I'll tell you what, James was, we'll talk about last episode real quick with James. He was having some headphone equipment problems and we did our best to make it work, but I wanted to at least give him the heads up that he was apologizing. He's like, man, I'm sorry. My headphones were giving out and I had all this background noise. But James always, like I said, he always brings the pain, and those were rough stories, man. I don't even know how we deal with, I'm surprised at how we deal with some of this crap. And I'll tell you what, Chuck, you posted a video that was for PTSD awareness, and it was a firefighter video, right? You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I showed it to my family. It's on our Facebook. It's on our Instagram. I felt like that video perfectly encapsulated in a little 40-second arc exactly what police, fire, veterans, nurses, EMTs, medics go through, because you have this horrific like description given to this dude who's in a daze as you get his inner monologue from the dispatcher telling this firefighter he's going to a call of a kid that's been dragged alive behind a car. When you get there, the kid will ask you if I'm dying, and your job will be to reassure her that she's not going to die. And the dispatcher voice says, Doug, when you get there, this little girl, and it goes through the whole thing. And then he just shakes his head and pulls his turnouts off the wall, gets in the engine and goes to work. And I told my wife, I said, that's the part that really spoke to me, is because you do have those thoughts and it does happen like that, but you do just saddle up and go to the next call.
Yeah. And a lot of people, a lot of cops and a lot of, I mean, there's a lot that cops, fire, military, doctors, nurses, they all have some sort of post-traumatic stress. Now, is it to the point where it becomes a major disorder where it's controlling their lives? Some yes, some no, some can live with it, but it's all about how you handle that, that full cup or that half full cup. You know, it depends on when your cup is overflowing. It's probably when it's time, and that's when you really should really start seeking help, or before that, because there's stuff that's rocked me, that shook me to the core, that I'm like, wow, I got to talk to someone about it, or I got to talk to people about it. And generally it's, you know, the people who are closest to you that help you out. But yeah, a lot of people deal with some sort of post-traumatic stress.
I can't have crazy after the stories you hear from James, how can not? But this episode, we are back with a brother from another mother in blue is Juan. How are you, Juan?
Good, man. How you doing?
Good. Do you know the video we're talking about?
No. I was trying to remember what he posted real quick.
It was real good. I looked at that. I'm like, that is how you tell a 40-second story, right? You know, it was really well done. But you have come on. You are no longer with the LAPD, but you spent over a decade at LAPD.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how, when you became a cop and what you're doing now?
Oh, man. I mean, we can go back to me being raised in the hood.
Yeah, that's the best way to be raised.
You know, it's funny. And I told this story, I think, one time. And when I was in I was actually raised in 77th Division.
And, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And
so for those of you in the audience that don't understand what 77th Division means, my father was assigned to 77th in 1972, fresh out of the academy. And he said when they were there, they would take pot shots at them in the parking lot of the station. Mm-hmm. And that there was some gangbanger running around the division, loosening the lug nuts on the personal vehicles of the cops that parked in the parking lot so that their tires would come flying off on the freeway on their way home.
Oh, yeah.
That's 77th Division. So you can imagine that Juan is saying that, no, he wasn't a cop there. I mean, he may have been, but he was raised there on the streets.
Oh, yeah. It was really wicked, man. I mean, the one time I think it was, I remember I was exactly like 14 years old, and me and my brothers, all my siblings were outside, and we were taught in the hood, when you see the police, just run.
Warner brother.
Yeah, just run, you know? And Chuck can attest to this because it still happens, you know? And I saw the patrol car coming, and it happened to be, you know, an officer from 77th Division just chasing me. And I'm running through the houses. He doesn't know what he has. I don't know why I'm running because I was just told to run, right? And he caught me, and he just grabbed me from the top of my shirt like this, you know? And he just said, man, why are you running? I was like, because they told me to run, you know?
It's the policia.
Yeah, man. It was probably the coolest, bizarre experience ever, man, because, you know, the images, they're, you're going to get beat down and stuff like that. Those officers were really cool about it. It just, you know, they were just coming down the street, just doing their normal patrol. And we just ran because, you know, we didn't look like we were just kids, you know.
And they probably knew that. And they probably were like, in a nice way, sending you a message that, hey, we're going to catch you. But then we're also going to dust you off and be like, dude, you don't have to run. It's cool.
Yeah. And I think that was the first positive image I ever had about law enforcement. I think that's what drove me to like, I'm going to be a copper, you know. And my path was pretty much different. You know, I went right from high school. I mean, the goal was to make it out of high school because a lot of these inner city guys, you know, they don't even make it out of high school.
Yeah, I saw Stand and Deliver.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's it right there. You know, that's it right there.
For real. That is legit. Yeah, I'm a victim of the LA County or LA City school system too, bro.
Oh, man, LAUSD right here.
Van Nuys, bro.
Yeah, I mean, then eventually, you know, I think when I made it to, you know, to the university, and you know, and I got an internship with the DA's office. That's where I started getting my feet in there. You know, I was there just working with the DA's. I was assigned to Compton Branch, so you already know where I'm going with
shit.
So, and you know, and I think I made my mind. Oh, I'm going to be a DA, right?
And from there, you know, I started talking to DA investigators that were all prior law enforcement guys. And they were telling me that, you know, you should try to be law enforcement and come back over here and have a cake job. That's what they told me.
And it's true.
I was like, just come over here and get paid. You know, at the time it was probably, you know, a good salary, right? And after that, I got into the academy right out of college, not waiting around, and never left. The plan was to just do your minimum 5 years and go to the DA's office. And I was just having too much fun.
The DA's office for some, it was a weird thing for me because growing up, the DA's office was just, you know, it was the DA's office. It was, you know, executive law enforcement.
Yeah. But
then when I went and worked in my own county, the DA's office, the DA investigator jobs were like the cream of the crop. They did all the OISs. Right. They helped on every homicide because it's smaller departments. It's just a different world when you get outside of LA.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the plan, but I never made it back because, you know, I got the itch to be, you know, a LAPD dog and
street copper.
And, you know, and then I went to do my probation at Van Nuys, which was probably the worst time of my life.
Really? Being on probation at Van Nuys or just those years in general?
Just that 1 year, man. It was fun. But you just got to be squared away, man, like anything else, man. And that's what, you know, that was the piece of advice I got from a lot of officers, man. So after that,
we were,
man,
part of the last good years of the last few good years before it went terrible.
Oh, yeah, man. I truly believe that, you know, because I talked to my cousin's in law enforcement right now, and he came in, I believe, like a 2010 around there. And my younger brother's in the law enforcement too. He came in probably in 2008, but I ended up going back where I was chased down 77th division.
There you go. Nice.
You know, I was there for a long time. I believe almost close to 8 years, man.
But you know what? I bet you that made you a hell of a street cop in 77th because you knew that neighborhood cold, man.
Oh, I to this day, I still remember my first traffic stop at 77th Division.
Okay.
My first traffic stop, a simple traffic violation, man. I walk up and I was like, "How you doing, ma'am?" She goes, "Why the fuck did you stop me for?" And I looked at her and I go, "Have a great day, ma'am," and walk back to my car.
That's hilarious.
Oh, my goodness.
What did you stop her for?
Just a broken tail light, man. And I was like, no. All right, let me go back to my car. I'm done. Mm-hmm. Good.
You always remember the first time someone questions you and is like, "What the fuck are you doing? Why'd you pull me over?" And you're like,
Yeah.
I never had that reaction. I was always like when they would say, "Why the fuck did you pull me over?" I'm like, you know, I've never seen someone talk their way into a ticket. And that's how I would start with. I think calm them down.
I took it as a welcome to the hood.
There you go.
They were, you know, and I was like, all right, got it. You know, this is how it's going to go down, you know?
And
that was it, man. After that, I was just, you know, I was really fortunate to work a lot of specialized units within just that one division, man. It was great. Good times, man.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, now you're no longer in law enforcement. You've transitioned to the private sector.
Yeah.
But we can talk about that a little bit more. The floor is yours, man. Tell us one of your stories.
Oh, I don't even know. I don't even want to start, man, because
I know, right? There's
because, you know, I worked 77's criminal surveillance team when they had that going, and I spent
like baby SIS.
Oh yeah, the little baby SIS. It was great overtime, by the way.
Right, I'll bet. That sounds overtime. Like a badass assignment. You know, for sure.
Oh man, and then, you know, I think it was one of those times where I was in narcotics for a prolonged period of my career. And
that was
intriguing. That was a lot of fun, man. And when you talk about they wrote policy off of your unit, we were it. You know, I think we changed a lot of things for that unit that I was assigned to. Well, 77th Division's narcotics team. It was I'll do a quick story about this one. It was one of those, you know. Back then it was so different because you and your partner just go and work leads, you know,
whatever
it happens. And if you have something coming, then you call the whole team. They'll come together and says, okay, what you have, what you need, you know. In my case, you know, I got a lead happened to be in a different city. You know, it was probably the nice. City. It was probably the city over Huntington Park, right? And you know, our boss was pretty lenient, you know, and his are we allowed to say their names here?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Whatever you want.
His name was Bob DeRozio. You know.
Oh, okay.
Bob DeRozio was just one of those guys. Okay, you know, he didn't care where it come from. You know, as long as you bring something back to the division, you can't come empty handed at the end of the day. You know.
No.
You got to come back with a good caper or whatever it may be. You know. And I told, hey Bob, I got a lead. He says, is it a lot of dope and guns or what we got? You know, I was like, just a lead about a drug dealer that sits in the corner of the house, you know, and sells dope. And he didn't even ask, you know, what city. He says, okay, go handle it, man. I says, and I'm thinking when I'm driving to this location in Huntington Park, man, should I tell him it's outside the city? You know,
jeez.
Because the rules are not set, my man, you know?
No.
You know?
Of course not. You make them.
Yeah, fuck it. Go on a field trip.
You know? So I got, you know, I've been, you know, tag along with the two officers that we're working with, Paul and Nick. And you know, we went over there and we sat on the car. I was like, whoa. And it was a lead from an informant, you know?
Right.
So.
Now, was he like reliable and shit? Or was he just some jackweed off the street?
Reliable. Reliable. Yeah, that's why
you know,
I was like,
you and I know, like, there's some people that are like, and I got some information, and then there's other people like, hey, check it out, and you're like, oh yes,
you know how to scream those guys out, man. Yeah, from the beginning. Yeah. You know, because sometimes they tell you what you want to hear and then you go out there and spend like the majority of your whole shift and nothing.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah, nothing comes. Sure. But this guy, man, we show up, we sit in the corner, and I'm like, okay, there's the car. Wow, okay, he's been telling the truth. We sat there. But nothing's happening, no hand-to-hand transactions, you know. And we figured, hey, let's just go talk to him, man. It's a different city, and whatever it may be, you know, it's really nothing, you know. We can't come back here all the time. So we actually jump on this guy, you know. We just walking up, and we're showing our badges. You know, old school, you know, the badge hanging around your neck, you know.
Yeah, sir.
You know.
That saved my life.
You know, and and then, you know what? It went 0 to 100 real quick, man. That guy just started. He jumps out of the car. We put him out of the car. It just starts fighting with us, man. And it's in the middle of the summer.
Oh, really? No words. Nothing. Just like, the fight's on.
The fight's on. So we're fighting this dude in the middle of Huntington Park. We didn't even notify the department that we're there in their backyard. So hence another change of policy there. You know,
I would say so.
Thou and then, shalt now notify.
Yeah,
that shall, emphasis on the shall.
Yeah. But this guy, man, it was like about, I vividly remember it was 108 degrees outside, man, and
that's hot.
It was hot.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We like normal stuff. We take the guy to the ground. We keep yelling at him. There were police officers, right? Of course, they don't believe it because, you know, you got a bearded Hispanic guy with cornrows, right? Yeah.
Please tell me that was you.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, nice.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to send us a picture of that.
Oh, dude, I'll send you the picture, man. That's all right. At my new job, they didn't believe me, but I was like, here's the picture, guys.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, it was a good fight, man. It was a good fight for 6 minutes, man. When I tell you, when people don't want to go to jail, they find a way, man, you know. And this is prior to me, you know, doing my jiu-jitsu stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But no, I tell people that all the time. I say, you know, you don't understand, you know, why do they have to do this? Why do they have to do that? I say, have you ever tried to hold on to a cat that doesn't want to be held on to?
Oh, shit.
There is a big dude. This straight. Oh. Awesome. You have to send that to us. We got to post that.
That's a, nobody believes you, man. Nobody that's believes awesome. You about that one. I played the role, man. You know?
That is straight, like that is straight Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Yeah, but man.
Anyway,
yeah.
It was one of those things I was saying about, you know, all the working together and doing all those kinds of things. It just gets crazy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, man. So
were you able to get on your radio and just at least notify, hey, I'm in a fight? Did you get any minutes rolling or anything like that, or just 6 minutes of straight you and your partner?
It was just 6 minutes to try to take this guy, man, because he was fighting. So, and it was so hot, man. I was getting my knees burnt, you know, and I'm sure the suspect on the bottom was like,
yeah,
cooking.
He's not feeling good either.
Oh, it was no bueno. But you know, we managed to get him to custody. Once we had him in cuffs, you know, then we started notifying, and we had a call, you know, our boss, and let him know what we got into. And he's
boss, we had to fuck somebody up.
Oh my god! Then we finally reached out to Huntington Park PD, and they finally showed up. And, you know, did you guys notify us? And we were like, nope.
what happened was there was a time.
Is this your neighborhood?
Hey, but you know, everybody came out, man. Everybody, you know how it is, man. Everybody comes out.
Yeah.
They had this. All I remember from the crowd was, and this is the times they had that big old VCR recording.
VHS camera on their shoulder.
Oh my god! I was like, everybody came out with those trying to record some of it, but the fight was done and over with, man. You know.
Well, and those were the days when, like, you could tell you were being recorded because somebody was carrying a boom box on their shoulder.
Oh my god. Yeah.
They had this big black box, and nowadays, like, you just have to assume you are recorded everywhere.
Oh, that most definitely. I mean, I feel bad for my brothers and sisters out there, man, because this, you just gotta assume now there's no way.
There's cameras everywhere. Know
that you're being recorded.
There's cameras on cars now, there's dash cams, like in just regular personal vehicles, you know, the license plate cameras. Mm-hmm. Not only for when backing up, but when driving, and you know, you have cameras in the side mirrors. It's nuts. Lots of people are in places are all wired now. It's intense. It's crazy.
And what's amazing is you still see how many times the cops actually still do it right.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So,
you know,
body cams cops are racist. We need body cams. The body cams prove the cops aren't lying. Body cams are racist. Right?
It's going there, guys.
That's exactly where it's going.
Yeah. Oh my god! Yeah, yeah.
Well, so when you were funny.
Go ahead.
It's about not notifying. agencies do a pretty good job of notifying when you come into different areas, divisions, or cities, and stuff like that. Hey, we're going to be working in your area. I've seen marshals come into an area, not notify anybody, end up coming over. Calling on a radio, not giving out good descriptions, and cops actually go in pursuit of the U.S. Marshals.
Wow. See?
And then they're like, no, it's not us, not us. And there's a lag because they're on their phones, and they finally have to turn on their ambers, on their undercovers, and then, you know, the copper's like, and the suspect gets away, and you're like,
yep. So nobody's happy.
I mean, definitely not, because now there's a pursuit report.
I watched a narcotics state sanctioned narcotics investigative commander actually rip a new asshole to a patrol cop, a street cop, because we were doing a dope surveillance on their south end of town. We had already put it out, you know, on the through the proper channels that we were playing, and we were doing the surveillance, and he went and ran a red light to take this car and follow it onto the freeway.
Right.
And he got pulled over by this street cop, this traffic cop, who wasn't paying attention at briefing when they heard that surveillance was being done at the south end of town. And he's like, "What the fuck is wrong with you? You don't ever fucking pull me over when I'm on an operation." I'm like, I'd never seen a plain. So to everybody sitting there, it looked like this big Hispanic dude in a nice polo shirt got out of this Nissan Sentra, walked up to this car and told him, "Don't ever fucking pull me over ever again."
Wow. Wow.
That was my favorite assignment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't regret the stuff, man, because that was life changing, man. The stuff that we did and were able to do in those times, you know?
Oh yeah.
Because
when you could still take people to jail for dope.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you could actually be a cop.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I'm just dumbfounded about the stuff, the changes, man. You know, you guys right now, these guys, their hands are tied behind their backs, man, when they really want to do God's will out there and you're not able to.
If God forbid it got really bad and, you know, these departments or these, you know, county sheriffs or whatever, if they start reaching out to retired coppers like me and like Juan to come back on the job, my only question is going to be this: are your policies exactly the same or similar to those of Wyatt Earp in Tombstone, Arizona? Because if they're not, I'm not coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, eventually it's going to get to a point where the lawlessness is just so bad. And so it's going to look like something out of freaking RoboCop. I mean, it's going to get to a point where the lawlessness is just too much. And, but yet no one wants the police to go do the job. And like when they started strapping cameras on cops and like damn near everywhere, I go, are you guys going to be using this to like broadcast like what we're doing? You know, you have shows like Cops and stuff like that that kind of gives a glimpse into the life of a police officer and how it is pretty dirty, but they're really not showing all the crazy shit. Now, sometimes they do and you get some good stuff, but for the most part, police work is a very dirty and dangerous job, and not too many people really want to see, you know, the really dark side and the nasty side that cops have to go through. I mean, when people don't want to go to the jail and they're fighting tooth and nail to not go, you don't want to post that all over the 5 o'clock news, because if you have an all out Donnybrook with, you know, a bunch of officers with a guy who's doped up out of his mind or just doesn't want to go to jail, or some female that's fighting or has a weapon or something like that, and then the worst happens and it's bloody and it's nasty, you don't want to see that. Your kids don't want to see that. But yet they're starting to broadcast it. And I look at it, I'm like, it's not something
you really don't know. I'm kind of on the fence now. I used to think that. And now I'm like, maybe their wife and kids should see that. Maybe everybody should see that and be like, listen, this is what you get. Like, if you think about the old West, like the public hangings and the shootouts in the middle of the street, people had to see it get that rough to really crave law and order that you saw from the turn of the century all the way through the 1950s. But if you think about it, it was only 60 years about 60 years between Wyatt Earp and Adam 12, right? It really was.
Yeah.
So now we're 60 years from Adam 12. So it's like a 60-year cycle. It's getting really, really, really bad. And so then people are going to crave law enforcement again, and they're going to crave actual security and safety. But one of the things they're going to have to wrap their head around, and I posted a link to this, and Chuck, I'll talk to you about doing a special episode on it. But I posted an article on our Facebook page. It was a link to it, and it was called A Nation of Cowards. And it basically was written in 1993. And when you read it, you're like, holy shit, this could have been written yesterday.
Yeah. Right?
But what the guy's basically saying is that we've gotten to this point where society feels like, you know, every life is sacred. So how dare we take a life, but also no life is worth, you know, a stolen purse or this or that or the other thing, because everything's measured in like intrinsic, you know, monetary value.
Right.
And instead you were supposed to measure like whether or not you were going to stand up for yourself by what it did to your dignity and what it did to your humanity, not by what it did to your pocketbook. So if some social miscreant tried to take your pocketbook, you didn't fight him because you needed the $5 in your wallet. You fought him because he was violating the social contract that said, no, motherfucker, you don't get to rob people. And if you do, I'm going to kick your ass. And then the cops can come later to take you to jail and put you on trial. The article basically said we've abdicated our personal responsibility for our own safety by saying, well, the police are supposed to do that, which then leads to this idea. Oh, there's never a cop around when you need one. Oh, I don't need a gun. The cops have guns. And then when the cops use them, guess what? They're the bad guys.
Yeah. They're the villain. You know, if every life is precious, I agree. Every life is precious, but my life is just as precious as yours. Don't try to take mine and I won't have to take yours. You know, you try to hurt me, I'm going to fight back. I'm not going to just let you do it. I'm wearing a badge. I have a family. I have a bulletproof vest on. I have my guns. I have my tools, you know, whatever. I'm here to protect the good, innocent people out there that need protection. And I'm supposed to take the evil people away and put them in jail. Well, now people are advocating for the evil people, like, oh, hey, you know, how is he supposed to make a living if he can't go out and rob people or steal shit? Well, I mean, I don't think that's the right thing. And how about you just abide by the law? Don't try to kill a cop. Don't try to kill innocent people. Don't try to hurt innocent people. And don't try to fight the police, and then you will never have a problem.
Well, and, you know, part of the things that brought up was how can police officers be expected to risk their lives for people who aren't willing to risk their own? Right? What? Oh, because you're paying him 40 to 80 grand a year, depending on where they live in this country? No. So you just put a value on that person's life. Oh, all life is sacred, except that fucking cop. His life's worth about 80 grand a year in overtime. With overtime. Yeah,
with overtime. And that's places that make like $30,000, $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
And those cops are busting their balls to protect your ass.
Yeah. That's crazy. So I just liked that piece, and I posted it, but I want to do an episode where Chuck and I actually break it down. It might be a special. Our next special episode is like going through this thing with a fine tooth comb. But anyway, yeah. Juan, you had some fun though.
I had fun, man. I had a great time. It's one of those things that I would never forget, that experience, man. I always tell even, you know, coppers that are right now, man, value your experience, man, and get as much training as possible, because that's going to take you places, you know?
Yes.
Yeah,
and there's more that you can do with it than you even possibly realize.
Oh, I didn't realize that after, you know, when I started hunting for, you know, from, you know, a new career, right?
Right.
And when you start valuing your, you know, you start listing your training and all that, and you put it on paper, you know, you know, you're somebody. you're somebody. You're not a normal individual, you know, and you just got to go out there and find it. And people,
I remember. Oh, go ahead.
No. And people will start coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Companies.
I remember the first time that I was basically voir dired in court and determined to be an expert on subject matter in court. And here I was not even 30.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had taught us in the academy that the legal definition of an expert is the person in the room who knows more than everybody else.
Yeah.
And the defense attorney wanted to put me on the stand and determine if I was an expert in narcotics manufacturing and sales, and asked me a ton of questions. And I remember he got about 6 questions in and the judge shut him down and went, he's clearly an expert, move on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went back and I'm like, yeah, the judge shut the voir dire down and said that. And everybody was like, oh, congratulations, you're officially an expert. You can put court appointed expert or court recognized expert on your resume. And I'm like, huh?
Yeah,
and it had never occurred to me that, you know, little old me was building a resume of other skills.
Yep.
That are transferable if you decide to look elsewhere.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And that's one of the main things that got me where I'm at right now. You know, it's just that experience, man. It goes a long way. You being able to talk about anything from law enforcement, from use of force. And that's what I do now. You know, I'm blessed. I'm blessed. You know, I tell, you know, coppers that are either going to go through, you know, who are planning leaving, or guys that were forced out, or border riots, you know, the whole nine,
right?
You know, take that training, go somewhere, man. Then somebody's going to pick you up, you know?
Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, they're going to be ex law enforcement, and they're going to know the bullshit you're coming from. They're going to understand the baggage you're bringing with you, and they're going to, you know, get it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You know, and that's what, you know, and that's what brings me, you know, when I was, I mean, I enjoy my time in life. I mean, the only thing people always ask me, man, do you miss it? I go, no, I miss the people. I miss, you know, the friends, you know.
I miss the job, like going code 3 and hooking and booking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I miss getting into fights and the fun stuff.
The fun. Yeah. That's the fun stuff, man. It's just the bullshit that comes with it after.
No.
So much right now.
So law enforcement's like a 20-year-old girlfriend. When you're 20, a 20-year-old girlfriend's worth all the bullshit. When you're 40, she ain't.
Oh my God, man. And this is a prime example. I remember when I was in narcotics, and same thing, informant. We worked through informants, and some guy goes, one of the informants calls me and say, hey man, there's about 8 dudes and they all got guns. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that's the first thing, right? Yeah. So we do a drive by. Okay, there's the 8 guys. Okay. And we sit on the main street somewhere on Vermont and 46th Street. And they all walking out.
Oh, you know, so real nice area.
Yeah. Come on. It's Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
You know, and they start walking out, and the informant tells me, hey, they're going to shoot a Hispanic dude, because it was a male black gang. I don't know what it was. I forget what they were. And I go, well, I started calling the whole team. Right. And they start pointing at the first Hispanic guy. I said, oh, man, I told my partner at the time, we're in a plane car. And I go, dude, we got to go now. Just go code six, bro. My God, man. Straight out of Miami Vice. You have me, of course, cornrows, you know. We start putting our vest on. He has the shorty shotgun, you know. And we have a 300 Chrysler, tinted windows.
Yes.
You know, we weren't thinking, man. We just did a U-turn and jumped out of the car and said, police, you know. And man.
And it isn't until you get home that night and go, fuck, that was cool.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
That was crazy, man, because it was just me and him. And the whole team saw this going down. Man, they start running, man. So me and my partner, he's chasing with the shorty shotgun and I'm chasing. They all run in the same directions. All you see is guys, guns flying.
Informant just got a hell of a lot more reliable.
Oh my God, man. And you know, we did all that and we did a follow up to the house where they came, got like an additional, I don't know, another like 7 guns and 2 rifles, right?
Jeez.
Did all that, man. I remember the captain coming in at the office. You guys did God's work. God's work.
Yes. You
know? God's work. I was like, oh shit. All right, captain. You win it.
That's police work, right?
Yeah, but
like, then, like that's what makes you feel.
But it was just this one small thing.
Uh-oh.
You know, I guess one of the suspects got in the back of his head, just a little blood, you know, scab, nothing, no use of force. That's what we thought. Watch commander says, use of force. Right?
For what?
For a little scab in the back.
How to get it?
I don't remember. You don't remember, man. So they did the use of force, and we tried to tell him there's not use of force, but the lieutenant at the 77 station said, hey, man, no, it's going to be use of force. What are we going to write? You know?
Exactly.
Oh, my God. But that.
I stared at him, and he started bleeding.
Yeah. That alone, man, it was a big high to just going down because they start looking into tactics, you know, everything else. And we had to go to a use of force review board, bro.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the captain, you know, oh man, the captain's going to go fight for us. You know, this review board.
My ass.
Nope. You know, he comes out and greets us. We all, we had to take off the beard and everything, man. We got to look presentable, right? Here comes the captain coming to us and says, hey guys, I'm going to go in there and say it's going to be an administrative disapproval.
What?
And I go, you're not even going to fight for us, Captain? You remember? God's will. God's work.
He's like, he was doing God's work. I have to do the chief's.
Yeah, at the time, before they found out it was, you know, that little dude made a complaint, you know.
Right, right.
And that was it, man. I was like, Jesus Christ, man. So that's what I mean. I missed the fun stuff.
Yeah. But
the administrative part when people have their own views of how police work should be done, but they're not the ones out there doing the work, you know?
Nor have they ever been.
Yeah, that's what gets me, you know. Yeah. So
well, we had a listener email I thought I'd run by you both. And it says, hey Tom, just wanted to ask you a couple questions. As I'm finishing up my bachelor's degree here in Bakersfield, California, a lot of people who are not my family are starting to ask the question, what am I going to get in? What am I going to get into, or what is the plan? And I say law enforcement here locally. However, I always get a weird face from them, like a facial expression saying, really? And I know it's in a negative way. I've even received comments that our local law enforcement has a bad reputation. Why is it always the same reaction for most people? Did you guys have similar experiences?
Oh, man. I'm from the hood. You know, everybody's saying, what are you going to do?
Why are you trying to be the man?
I know.
Trying to be the man.
You know?
You probably lost a lot of friends, right?
See, this conversation we're having, man, reminds me of just stories, man. Because yeah, I had a lot of friends and I lost a lot of friends, you know,
right.
People didn't, you know, but it's funny, man, because they saw when I was back in the hood and they saw me in uniform, it was a mutual respect back then.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because, you know, you have somebody who knows what's going on in the hood giving back to the community. You don't see that often. you know?
Right. You weren't some, you know, redheaded, freckle-faced white boy from Thousand Oaks who had never even heard of 77th, let alone been there. Yeah. You were a local kid and you knew what was up.
Yeah. So I think, but I dealt with that, man. It was just, you just got to be more mature about it and, you know, and just, you know, let those friends go, man. You know, you know, because they don't have understanding of what you're trying to do. You know, you have to worry about yourself, you know, at the end of the day. So
the people that are never going to understand you are never going to understand you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And now the question is, like, if they don't understand you, do they judge you and treat you like shit? If the answer to both of those questions is, yeah, you know, they don't understand you, but yes, they treat you like shit and then fuck them. You don't need them. But for the people that like, I don't understand you, but I support you. I love you. It's cool. Then those are your people.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And then the people that do understand you, like, fuck yeah, that's awesome. Then cool.
Yeah.
Just make sure they don't treat you like shit too.
Man. So here's my take on that whole thing. I never had a chance to work where I grew up. I would have loved to have had that opportunity because I knew where all the shitty spots were, you know, things like that. I knew where to go to really affect crime and crime suppression and things like that. Never had the chance. I would have done it in a heartbeat if I ever got that opportunity to work where I grew up because there's a sense of ownership and a sense of pride into making that area better and a better place. But here's the thing. Here's my take on it. If I lived in that area, I would never have thought about being a police officer in that area. One, I came from a police officer background, family was cops. Not all of my family, but my dad, my aunt, friends, couple friends, parents were all cops. I would never work where I lived. So if he is working or if he wants to work where he lives, I would say, you might want to move first, move your family out because that could have unnecessary blowback. You know, you don't want to be going to the supermarket and you see the guy you just hemmed up and just arrested and put a case on, you know, legally, you know, you don't want that because far too often cops get in scuffles and fights because they live in an area where they patrolled and then the suspect that they've arrested prior or multiple times recognizes them and they're out getting groceries. And then now they get into a, you know, a full blown fight, which is going to end up turning into use of force. And now you're fighting for your life off duty, which you don't have resources. You don't have your weapon. Maybe you have one gun on you, but at the same time, you know, you don't have backup that you can call at the flick of a switch on your radio. So I would say if you live in that area, don't be a cop in that area or move out, move your family out. If you want to be a cop, go for it. Choose a good area. Choose an area with pay. If you want that sense of ownership and pride, do it smartly. Don't be like, oh, I'm just going to become a cop in this area. My whole family lives in this area. That's great, but you could have some unnecessary blowback.
And how big is the area? Like, you can work for LAPD and never live in the same division where you work.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know if Bakersfield, absolutely. I know Bakersfield's big, but I don't know if it's big enough for somebody to work on the south end of town and live on the north end of town and have nothing of those two worlds ever meet. I think it's, I think it's kind of difficult. I would say I agree with you. I would totally work where I grew up, but I would never live where I work.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Now,
and that just would, for you, Juan, I'm sure it's easier because you're not going to live in nobody should live in 77.
No, I did. No, I was way, so, I was gone.
You were way gone. And way gone. For me, you know, I grew up in area of the San Fernando Valley and an area of Santa Clarita. And, you know, if I worked in that area,
but you had coppers living,
I wouldn't patrol there.
You had coppers living in 77. You guys remember that, that buyback program?
Officer Next Door program?
Officer Next Door. That's when every copper was buying every house in the hood.
Yep. And then they told him, no, you actually have to live there. Sorry, what?
What? Yep, exactly. They changed the rules. They changed the rules, but I remember that.
Yeah.
So. I mean, you know, Bakersfield is super, super small. Like, it's big, but it's very small and it's very violent. Mm-hmm. I've talked to cops up there. I've talked to agencies that are bordering that area. And it's got some violent parts. It's got some dangerous parts. It's got some really nice parts. But at the same time, it'd be like going up to the Antelope Valley and say the Antelope Valley had its own police department, AVPD. Right. Let's call it AVPD. And you want to live on the west side but patrol the east side. You're going to have one common mall that y'all go to. Bakersfield has like one mall, one central location where everybody shops. So if you go to the Costco and you work on the south side of town, but you live on the northwest side of town, and you go to Costco, you have a possibility of seeing someone that you hemmed up and arrested, and maybe, you know, they're really pissed, their family's pissed. And now you have your kids with you, your family with you, and now they're in a dangerous situation that they should never have been in the first place.
Right. And I can't tell you, my father warned me, you know, all the years I was growing up, and then I warned my family. And I know horror story after horror story of cops who have had stuff happen to them off duty that either caused the injury or death of their wife or their child or of all manner of things. I can tell you 100% when I worked NARCS, my daughter was in kindergarten. It was the first year I was working NARCS, and I was picking her up from school one day. And she was telling me about her bestest, you know, little kindergarten friend, her first school friend, and how she wanted her to come to her birthday that summer. And I said, "Well, which one's your friend?" She points to her, and I said, "Oh, okay." And then I looked at the adult that she was walking with. I'm all, "Who's that lady with her?" She's like, "I think that's her mom." And I'm all, "Yeah, she can't come to your birthday. I'm sorry." And she didn't know why. And I went and told my wife, I'm like, "We're putting a case on that girl. She's a doper. She, you know, like I don't live here, but I work undercover countywide. So I know who this chick is." And, you know, those kinds of things, that was county, like the whole county. You still couldn't escape it. So it's just one of those things where it's never, if you can lessen the chances of that kind of thing happening to you and your family, do it.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I live in a different city than where I work, and I've still come in contact with people that I've hooked up.
Yeah. Well,
or I've been working and I've hooked up people that live in the city that I live in. And I'm like, oh shit. You know, it's, you know, and I remember, and this happened to a couple guys I know. I was in a Best Buy and I recognized someone I had arrested, and I was like, oh shit, gotta go. And I grabbed my family and I bounced. And I've personally seen officers get into fights off duty. Well, not personally seen it, but like they're friends of mine, and I've personally heard the story.
Right.
And they've gotten fights with people because they either lived in this similar division or neighboring city or whatever, and that to me, that's just not safe. I mean,
no,
I get it, you want to have pride in where you live and take care of the people where you live, but at the same time, you're in a profession where everyone hates you.
Yeah, well, it depends. People. I mean, okay, so if you're talking about the level of bad people that are in 77th, yeah, don't live there and police there. If you're talking about the level of bad people that are in, you know, Pocatello, Idaho. Okay, you could probably live there and police there.
It's different.
It's totally different. So I think there's a sliding scale. Bakersfield falls into this weird, it's not small town enough to be, yeah, no big deal, but it's too big to be, you know, like nothing.
Right. I wouldn't do
it's
it.
Like, yeah. So anyway, just food for thought. And then we got an email from Rob. Rob's been a longtime listener. He's emailed us a bunch of times, but he wanted to email us about our last episode with James. He says, the part where you guys were talking about burnout makes, or no, two episodes ago, part about burnout makes sense. We were talking about burnout, and he says, my fire department is small, 12 firefighters usually, and we are all paid on call. The district we served is large in square miles, but low in population. There's an intersection of major interstates that's a few miles away, and that's where we saw most of the big shit. So now to burnout. It took me 30 years to hit it. My first year, I saw 3 shotgun suicides, a double suicide by train, and a 7-year-old girl killed in a structure fire. I found her buried in a char pile of clothes in her bedroom. She looked like an anatomy model you'd see in a high school health class. And in the years after that, there were more incidents, of course, but the wall was hit for me when we had a 3 semi pile up on the interstate. That was the one he told us about before. And after the call, I told the chief I was done. I couldn't let any more into my head. I'd seen enough. The sound of the tone brought out groans in him. And he was debating with himself on when he was going to go. So that's what Chuck was talking about, even in this episode a little bit, which is when that cup is full, you know, when you've reached that point, you know, where you're like, nope, it's going to go somewhere. So whether you spill it out onto your family, you spill it out onto your dog, you spill it out onto your liver, or you spill it out onto, you know, all three simultaneously, it has to go somewhere.
All right.
So anyway, well, Juan, we usually give our guests,
hold on, Tom. Chance.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you and I both talked to this kid. I told him that I would address it on this episode.
Oh yeah. What is it?
I know this is a little lengthy, but, this real quick, he goes, do you guys have any recommendations for pursuing a career in emergency management, specifically for educational facilities? What kind of recommendation are you looking for? And then, would you recommend state, federal, or local? Any books that you think would help? Should I be looking for internships in general or internships specifically geared towards schools or in colleges? And I put on there, so you want to work on management side. So I would say federal, like FEMA or DHS. Local, you need to work your way up as a beat cop to upper management. Go into more depth on the episode, Chuck. And he goes, thank you. Looking forward to it. So
sure.
I was in college, and emergency management is very vast. It's very big. And people like FEMA work on a national scale of emergency management. And you know, you have courses in major municipal areas, that big PDs and stuff like that, where they have a whole scale and system of what you want to work. So if you're going to go into like a local law enforcement, you want to work in emergency management. Well, you can do that as a lieutenant, as a captain.
It's going to take you 25 chief. Years to get to
it's,
that.
It's going to take you a long time to get there. Now, if you go onto like a federal scale, DHS, FEMA, shit like that, you know, FEMA was who was responsible for Hurricane Katrina. And they learned a lot from that because they messed up a lot. And those are the people who are asking for, you know, other things. And it also falls on the municipal areas, you know, calling for mutual aid, having certain natural disaster setups. But if you want to go and work for like schools and stuff like that in emergency management, that's probably going to be more of like a school resource officer, but at the same time, upper management. So you're going to have to work your way up. And my best advice for you would be, one, go to college, get a degree in criminal justice, get a master's degree in business. And if they offer one for emergency management, do it.
And there are emergency management degrees. You don't even have to go to a physical school. You can get them online.
Yep. Exactly. University of Phoenix, you can go and you can get damn near anything you need. Do it for the comfort of your home and be working at the same time making money.
Exactly.
I would add this, because there's a – so I'm a little bit – I was trying to get my dad. I couldn't get him on the phone, but he – is actually in emergency management now. He retired from LAPD. When he retired, he was the officer in charge of the Emergency Operations Center unit, where he was basically running the Emergency Operations Center for the city of LA during the OJ riots and the Northridge earthquake, it was a big deal. And he now, where he retired after LAPD, went on to another career working for the state of California. And the state of California, state of Texas, and many other states, in fact, most other states in one way or another, have an Office of Emergency Management or an Emergency Management Division or something that's run by the state that tries to coordinate emergency management efforts and disaster efforts on the state level when they don't even rise to the federal level. And so that's another route you can look into in it. If you don't want to go to FEMA, you can also go and look into it on the county and state level.
Right.
If you're going to go into public safety and get into emergency management, honestly, the best way you could go is get onto a damn fire department. They are the kings of the incident command system, and they're the kings of emergency management. And you'll probably be able to work your way into a desk job in emergency management faster as a firefighter than you would as a cop.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's true.
That's true.
It'd be harder for you to get onto a fire department than a police department.
Yeah. So, you know, so I guess to close out, if you guys are in law enforcement getting ready to retire, or for something happened that you have to leave or something like that, there's always going to be a job out there for you. Know your worth. Mm-hmm. I know Juan said it before, know your worth. And Juan has probably one of the coolest jobs, and I'm kind of jealous, for force option simulations. For those of you who don't know, that's going to be a FOSS system. It's like a video game that you can put yourself through different scenarios, and kind of go through it and do training instead of just going to the range, but you get to put yourself in a scenario based, you know, video game with a gun, with an air gun, and work your way through all these different shoot, no shoot scenarios and shit like that. And I think that is incredibly awesome what you do. And I think it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Pretty jealous.
It's really awesome to be able to provide that kind of training to these police departments.
Did I get that right? That's basically what you do, correct?
Yeah. No, you know that, man, because that's what I'm blessed with, man. I'm no longer directly involved, but I'm involved. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I get to visit a broad perspective of law enforcement across the nation. And it's wonders, man. Yeah, I get to see how other agencies operate and how they do their thing. And, you know, and all we're doing, you know, what Inveris Training Solutions is doing is just adding to their game, making them better. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. And you get to travel.
Oh, don't even get started with
every time I talk to you, you're like, oh, I'm traveling. I'm doing this.
You know what? And they're good about family life, man, because and I'll give you a perspective. You know, the unit that I'm assigned is from law enforcement section, right? All those guys are all ex-law enforcement. You have a guy from Atlanta PD, another guy from Secret Service who was involved directly with the Obama administration. He was the head of, he was a counter sniper there. An FBI guy who was in Waco, involved in Waco.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. He was one of those, what is that called? The SRT teams.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like,
yeah, street team. He was involved with that one, you know? And then you got an old Miami Vice copper who still wears his shirt tucked down. It's just crazy, man. You know, the guy
is like a sleeveless pink muscle shirt,
you know, silky, white, right?
Linen jacket, like Italian loafers with no socks.
Is that But I'm gonna tell you this, man. I've been everywhere.
Bring that back. Could we bring that back?
I could tell you this, man. I've been everywhere and I've seen law enforcement agencies and they always look at the West Coast agencies to see what they're doing.
Yes.
You know, that's the first thing they see, you know. And it's
even
still, man.
They still
it's technologically and training wise and policy wise, as goes California, especially LAPD, San Diego PD, San Francisco PD, the major police departments, as goes those departments, so goes the rest of the country eventually.
Yeah. And I'll tell you
don't see anybody trying to emulate Chicago PD.
No. Oh, no. I mean you're talking about in the Middle East in Dubai, where Dubai Police Department was asking, you know, because we're everywhere, we're worldwide, our company, right? And they were asking, hey, is LAPD doing this? Is LAPD using this system to train off of it?
Right.
So when they found out that they have a hype for LAPD, my director calls me, you need to get on
you're
the
going
flight.
To Dubai.
You're going to Dubai. You know? And it was crazy to me, man. It's just crazy. You know, how everybody emulates.
Yeah. You know, Elliot has talked about this on the show, and my dad has talked about this. My dad has flown to other countries to teach, and Elliot has flown to places around the world for conferences and stuff. And he has been around foreign police departments, people in foreign military. And when they find out that my dad or Elliot worked for LAPD, they are all of a sudden just like, it's like this celebrity crush.
Yes.
And they even will ask, do you have can I see the badge? Can I see the badge? Because they just want to see a real LAPD badge close in real life.
Yeah.
It's so famous. It's like the Superman symbol.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to be a comic book fan to know what Superman's symbol looks like. And it's the same thing with LAPD's badge. Yeah. Dragnet and Adam 12 and all these shows that have played, you know, Columbo and everything's LAPD.
And it's nuts, man. I was in Barbados with their Royal Police Department there. And when they found out I was LAPD, the first thing they do is they take me to their version of the hood, you know. And me and my partner, who used to work Atlanta PD, were like, he's taking us to traffic stops that officers are doing. And I said, you guys like this? I said, It's all the same to me, man. You know, yeah. I said, can you take us where all the Rihannas are at?
Margaritas.
Yeah, right?
Where all the Rihannas, margaritas are at, man. He goes,
yeah.
Oh, you guys don't want to see no, man. Save that for tomorrow. Yeah. That's awesome. But yeah, I've been blessed, man. I, you know, I'm fortunate to use the training and apply to how, when I get in front of police departments, you know, how to use the system, how to apply their use of force, man. And you see some raggedy stuff out there, man, when they get behind that system, man. I'm like, whoa, you're a police officer? All right.
Okay, cool. Tight. And it's not their fault.
No.
It really isn't.
No.
That's why if you ever LAPD had its own TV show called LAPD Life on the Beat. I know many cops that were featured on LAPD Life on the Beat. And then there was the show Cops. And even though LAPD Life on the Beat wasn't super, like, it was only LAPD, so it was only one little section of law enforcement, but it also was, you know, it spanned the entire city of Los Angeles. So it's like we said, it's its own little country. When you watch Cops, though, you see all these other different smaller agencies do it. Yeah. And you realize, like, that show can show you the exact wrong way to do that job on so many levels.
Yeah.
Because if police work is done right, it's kind of boring.
Yep.
So anyway,
well, Juan, I'm so happy that you, like, truly stoked that you have the job that you do. And it's really amazing to see that you're out there and you're helping other law enforcement agencies and other coppers in their job and in bettering their tactics and stuff. And I think it's pretty amazing.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it, man. It's just, you know, I'm grateful, man. That's why I don't take nothing for granted anymore, man. You know,
absolutely.
It humbles you out, you know, when, you know, you're on top of the world, and sometimes that could, you know, you have to start over again, and, you know, you just don't give up, you know.
Nope.
One of the things I always, if I could take one thing from what I could say to coppers out there who are probably listening to this, is like, know your work, man, you know, and, you know, prepare yourself for, you know, because this job can never be promised all the time, you know.
Yeah, and especially in this day and age where they're going to cut you loose quick.
Oh, yeah.
Real quick.
You're prosecuted by, you know, by your, not anymore by your peers, but whatever the media dictates, you know.
Yep.
So, but I truly believe that, man. And I'm blessed where I'm at. And, you know, being able to sit down and chit chat with you guys, that's very cool.
Well, no, that we appreciate. And we want to have you back because obviously you're coming up with stories more and more as we talk about it. So we're going to have to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're hitting on points and I'm just like, oh, I got to tell this story. Oh, I got to tell this
story. Write them down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's see. We normally dedicate an episode. We let our guests dedicate an episode to a brother officer, sister officer, sister firefighter, brother firefighter, anybody that they know that lost their life in the line of duty. If you have somebody, one. If not, we have somebody that we
can. Oh, no, I don't have. Sorry, man. I wish.
Okay. No, that's okay. We always give our guests the chance to dedicate it to somebody if they want to. But we will then dedicate this episode. This kind of I like to do these from time to time. This is out of West Virginia, a Navy sailor who died in the World War II attack on Pearl Harbor has been identified. Wow. Authorities used DNA and dental records to identify Navy pattern maker first class Stanislaw Drawl, 25 years old, from the POW MIA accounting agency. Wow. Essentially, he was killed on the battleship USS Oklahoma in 1941 when Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese. However, at the time that his remains were recovered from the ship, they weren't able to be identified. So they were just buried in 1949 in 46 different plots in the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. But I guess 2015, the Department of Defense started to exhume all of those remains and have basically decided we're going to try and identify them and give them a proper burial. So it's pattern maker first class Stanislaw Drawl. We rest easy, brother. We got it from here. And finally, you're being laid to rest properly, as you would have wanted to. So that's who we dedicate this episode to. Juan, do you have anything else you wanted to throw out there to people?
No, man. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it, man. This is really fun, man. It actually brought a lot of memories back, man.
That's good.
Because I don't get a chance to actually chit chat with officers because my colleagues are all spread out throughout the United States.
Yep.
So, but when we get together, this is what we do. We
This is
start talking
exactly.
war stories, you know?
Well, hey, let any of them know if they want to come on. I'm sure you got guys from all over the country that
Oh, yeah.
you're
Oh,
working with.
definitely.
Any of them with military experience, any of them with police firefighter experience, you tell them they're welcome on anytime.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I'll put the word out for sure.
Yeah,
Chuck,
thank you.
Where can they email you?
So they can email me at booking.warstories@gmail, or you guys can go to the Instagram page, direct message me or Tom.
It's really easy. It's much easier to direct message him through Instagram as well, by the way.
It's super easy. And then if we start getting into it and I'm like, hey, I want to make sure that I can lock this down because people send messages and shit gets lost, I'll send you the email and just click it and send me whatever you got and we'll talk. Send me your phone number. We'll talk over the phone. We'll iron everything out. But again, that's booking.warstories@gmail, or go to War Stories Official on Instagram and then direct message us there. So if any of your buddies want to come on one, if you guys want to come on together and
shoot
together
to us directly, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll
awesome.
We'll, yeah. I mean, you can have them mess with me on my personal account. You can have them cause you obviously have it and you can go to the Instagram, whatever, and we'll get it. But yeah, that's where you guys can go. We're still working on the stickers and all the other stuff. It's been a little bit hectic here, and it's been a little bit hectic for Tom and I. So
yeah, and we're still coming up with got people messaging us. Like I said, if you haven't got your order, because some of the stuff we were out of and we had to reorder and stuff like that, and other stuff because it got lost during the move, and some stuff where we just don't know where it is. If the post office, I've had one where right now the guy says, I don't know where it is. I said, okay, I'll just send you a new one. So, that's, you know, just make sure you hit us up. It's most of them got taken care of, but there was like, I don't know, two or three stragglers recently that got missed, and the stickers are on their way. Some new designs we're working on, as well. That's how you can support us. You can also support us by becoming members on our website or by becoming members on Podbean, which gives you exclusive access for, like, right now we have the end of watch episode just sitting there waiting to be listened to. But if you're not a member, you can't listen to it. Anyway, so with that in mind, we appreciate everybody for listening. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.